Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
How can European look at a non-European literature from a non-European perspective? It's impossible because you're European, just as I, a Chinese, I'm looking at American culture from the Chinese point of view.
Some people in the Soviet Union and outside the Soviet Union, including the United States, criticized Thoreau for his extreme individualism, for his entire social thinking.
Cultural scholarship in the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China, this week on Soundings. My guests are Yang Zhohan, a literary scholar from Peking University, and Nikita Pokrovsky, a professor of philosophy at Moscow University. First on Soundings this week, a discussion with Nikita Pokrovsky about his study of 19th century American literature and philosophy. Following that, Yang Zhohan discusses the study of English and American literature in the People's Republic of China. Nikita Pokrovsky, welcome to Soundings. It's a pleasure to have our first scholar from the Soviet Union at the National Humanities Center.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your project. Why is a Russian philosopher interested in the American culture of the 19th century?
Well, that's a long story indeed, but to be short, I would say that many years ago I got acquainted with people like Jefferson and Thoreau, not personally, of course, but through their books and right. their intellectual heritage, indeed. And immediately after that, I felt myself involved in the stream of the history of American thought and social philosophy.
What is it that invited you? Can you be specific for me?
Oh, yes, of course. This is the spirit of freedom, the spirit of free criticism, and the idea that everything is possible if a human being can really follow his or her dream.
Now, there may be some people listening to this broadcast who would say, now, that's an odd thing to hear from a Soviet academic.
No, not at all.
Why?
Not at all, because we can find a lot of such people in the history of Russian thought. But for me, it was really much more important to see the ideas and people on the other side of the ocean and to introduce them to my fellow public in the Soviet Union. And little by little, gradually, this became not only a part, but I would say the main objective of my personal academic life at the university, a kind of establishing a kind of introduction of American thought to the Soviets.
Let's talk about Henry David Thoreau,
yes,
Nikki Pokrovsky. You've written a small book about Henry David Thoreau.
That was my first book.
Yeah. Why did Thoreau attract you? What was it there that you found appealing?
It might be a very long story with many names and ideas, but to be short again, I would like maybe to cite very briefly what Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian man of letters, wrote about Thoreau, and which was exactly my appreciation of Thoreau and my main impetus when I started to learn Thoreau and to teach his philosophy. Tolstoy wrote down in his journal, "Today I, feeling weak, read Thoreau and was spiritually uplifted." This is the main spirit of Thoreau's books, that you feel a kind of being uplifted by his reading, even being weak, I would say, spiritually or even physically.
Isn't it also true, though, Nikki Pokrovsky, that Thoreau was a great critic of his society?
Yeah, and I first was introduced to Thoreau at the time when, you know, even in the Soviet Union, Thoreau was not very much persona grata. I would say. Right. Of course, I should be very objective. He was translated in the Soviet Union and published two times before I came across him.
Now, he would have been persona non grata. Why? Because he criticized the state?
Yeah, because, you know, any person in any strong establishment who can say under government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison,
right,
would be considered a person which is not probably very much appropriate to the status quo establishments. But I would say that Thoreau never wanted to be liked, but he always wanted to be loved. Mm-hmm. And this makes a great difference, at least to my understanding, because we have so many people who want, on both sides of the ocean, in both countries, who wanted to be liked and don't care about being loved. Mm-hmm. Thoreau somehow represented the people who wanted to be loved, and that's very important indeed.
Why is he appealing to you again as a philosopher? There are, for example, in this country, Nikita Pokrovsky, there are scholars who will tell you that Thoreau really isn't a philosopher. He's a fine writer. He has a great blueprint for society, but philosophically, he may be a little soft. How do you react to that?
Yeah, that would be. Well, that's an important point, because when I first moved forward my draft with study of Thoreau, I was exactly told the same things at University of Moscow. Hmm. And many people were opposing to my project, not because they disliked Thoreau, but because they didn't want to see him as a philosopher. But when I finished my PhD dissertation something like 12 years ago, and when I published several articles and a book and a collection of Thoreau journals and essays in the Soviet Union and Russian. So many people changed their mind, and I'm very happy about that.
You are his defender.
Yes, I'm a kind of a proponent and defender of Thoreau in the Soviet Union so far.
Well, let's use that as a departure point as we move toward a conclusion of our conversation, Nikita Pokrovsky. It is, if not fashionable, it's certainly visible, current in scholarship in the United States to say that we look for the here, the now, the political. We find ways in which our study of the past may not transcend time in terms of great lasting mm-hmm. themes. We look for what echoes of our own time or foreshadowings of our own time. And I bring us back to that first question. Why is a Soviet scholar interested in American 19th century culture?
Yeah, that's really very interesting, Dr. Pond. I think that we are all shadows of our own past, and our future is the shadow of the present and of the past. And if you remember this famous saying by American philosopher Santayana, saying that all people who I just cited, people who do not know their past, are inclined to repeat it once again.
Condemned to repeat it.
Condemned, yes, to repeat it once again. So for me, as a historian of philosophy, history of cultural thought, the past is something which is present in our contemporary days.
Is the past more important to the Russian people than it is to our American people?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, we are, the critics, Nikita Pokrovsky, tell us that we are raising a generation of Americans that is ahistorical, that doesn't really know its past. Is that does that have a correspondence in the Soviet Union?
I cannot agree with that. So after celebration of bicentennial in the United States, I could and I can see the traces of the uplifting interest in American history among Americans.
Now, that was a media event. That isn't necessarily something that gets echoed in the schools themselves.
I mean, you mean in schools of thought.
Yeah, but no, I mean in American education. My question, though, is that it comes to this. Do you think that your people, your culture, Soviet people, are they more keen on the past, on history, than Americans? Am I asking you an impossible question?
No, it's quite possible, and I follow your question, and I would say it depends. It depends what particular people you are talking about, mm-hmm. and it depends upon what particular time you are talking. So now, of course, there is a huge interest in the history of the Soviet Union since 1917. So we have a kind of a re-evaluation of the certain stages of the development of the Soviet Union, and it's highly politicized. Uh-huh. I mean the history now in the Soviet Union. So some people and very important people are talking with the countrymen now through history, making different judgments, historical judgments, making new new approaches to historical figures like Stalin and Lenin, Trotsky, Bukharin, and many other people.
When you say new approaches, Nikita Pokrovsky, are we using words like honesty and truth when in the Soviet scholars' effort to retrieve the past?
Yes, I would say so. Honesty and truth should be always with a historian in his vocabulary.
Yeah, whatever they are.
Yeah, well, that's another question, and we can talk for hours about that. But nevertheless, I think that moral judgments should always be present in historical analysis, whether they are written in your text or they exist somewhere behind your mind. Mm. But that was specifically my approach to Thoreau. I liked him.
Let's conclude our conversation, right, Nikita Pokrovsky. Do you think that your presence at the National Humanities Center, is that just a fluke, or are we talking about a natural kind of consequence of perestroika and glasnost and all of this stuff that President Gorbachev is attempting to achieve in the Soviet Union?
Dr. Pond, I think that my personal presence and an invitation by the center and to the center was a part of the new approaches in Soviet American cultural relationship. And I'm, frankly speaking, I'm very proud of being the first Soviet scholar at such an important establishment like the National Humanities Center.
I take it you think this is a good thing, this exchange.
This is extremely good thing, personally, and I would say even from the standpoint of my colleagues at the university, because you even cannot imagine how important my personal presence here is to my colleagues and friends in the Soviet Union, and especially at the university, because they are really waiting for me come back and report them about everything I have here. And no doubt my report will be very favorable, believe me.
Well, we're still early in our academic year here at the center, but I hope the report will be favorable. Let's conclude our conversation, Nikita Pokrovsky. What would you say to an American audience? We have general listeners, people who they're not all academics. They're interested in scholarship and history. What would you say to them about the nature of what you do? Why is it important? Is it different than compared to what goes on in the American Academy, university professors, that sort of thing?
I would say to my American listeners that if you really want to understand Russia and the Soviet Union as an important ingredient in the world culture and civilization, you should study more the history of Russian thought and contemporary Russian politics and ideas, because without your personal evaluation of what is taking place in the Soviet Union, you cannot or you will not be able to understand many things. And please do not try to make one-dimensional judgments. Russia and the Soviet Union, as well as the United States and any other country, is multidimensional, not only three-dimensional, multidimensional. And that's very important, I guess, for the Americans to understand.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Nikita Pokrovsky, a professor of philosophy at Moscow University. Nikita Pokrovsky is the first Soviet scholar to hold a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he's at work on a study of American transcendentalism. Soundings continues now with a conversation featuring Yang Zhohan, a professor of English at Peking University. During his recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Yang Zhohan worked on a study of Baroque literature.
How are you looked upon as a teacher of English and American literature? Are you an entirely rare breed of scholar in the People's Republic?
No, I wouldn't think so, because in my own generation, for instance, there are quite a number of very excellent scholars in English and American literature teaching at various universities in China.
Are you looked upon with any suspicion?
During the Cultural Revolution, yes. Mm-hmm. but not at other times, no. In China, almost every university has an English department.
Mm-hmm.
And in these English departments, English and American literatures are normally taught.
What, for example, do you teach, Mr. Yang?
Well, I have not been teaching for many years because I was engaged in compiling a textbook, The History of European Literature, for quite a few years, beginning from probably from 61 till 66, when the Cultural Revolution broke out. And then everything stopped. And afterwards, I had a couple of graduate students, and instead of undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
And so I offered courses like 17th century English literature and Shakespeare and the like.
Tell me, for example, how does Shakespeare go over with Chinese students? In the West, Shakespeare
I think he's one of the best loved authors in China, because he's among the few European writers whose complete works have been translated into Chinese.
What about American writers? Who are the popular writers?
I think in recent times, the most popular American writer is probably Faulkner.
William Faulkner.
Faulkner, yes. Mm-hmm. And before him, of course, Hemingway, and also Fitzgerald. You know, writers of the 30s, they are very popular.
Why would that be? What is their particular peculiar appeal to Chinese readers?
I think with Faulkner, he is entirely different from any American authors that have been introduced into China.
Are there themes, for example? Are there ideas in Faulkner's writing, concerns with history, of the family, with region, with location?
I think that has a great deal to do with the introduction of Freud into China. And the Chinese readership begins to be interested in the psychological aspect that of characters in novels, for instance. And that's why, especially Sound and Fury, which is very difficult to translate.
It's difficult to read in English, you
bet. Yes. But as far as popular literature is concerned, I think novels like Gone with the Wind has been very, very popular in China.
How freely does Western literature, particularly the literature of England and the United States, how freely does this circulate in the People's Republic?
Oh, the circulation is enormous. It goes up to sometimes to a million copies.
Would we use a word like censorship when we describe what gets circulated?
I don't think there's any kind of censorship. Mm-hmm. There may be I wouldn't call them discussions, but there may be some arguments about certain kinds, types of novel, like Lady Chatterley's Lover, for instance.
In other words, it doesn't have anything to do necessarily with
political censorship.
Political themes. It's erotic literature.
Oh, yes, yes. For instance, The Diary of Dr. Zhivago has been translated, and that is okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a few minutes, Yang Johan, about your own work. You're here at the Humanities Center writing a book about the Baroque in, I take that, 16th, 17th century English literature.
Yes.
You're doing that on its own terms, or are you looking at it in terms of Chinese literature? What are you after?
Well, primarily, it was I did it because the concept of Baroque has been very little known among Chinese students of Western literature. And secondly, because there are scholars here in this part of the world who try to impose the concept broke onto Chinese poetry.
What, you mean in formal terms?
In formal terms.
Uh-huh. The way the words look on the page. All right, and you object to that imposition?
I don't agree, because to my mind, Baroque is the designation of an entire culture. It is not merely a literary style. Stylistic features can be repeated in different literatures, but cultures cannot. Baroque culture is geographically and historically constrained, limited to Europe of the 17th century.
Well, then why would you want to take this to Chinese audiences, or in what fashion do you
present? Well, I want to introduce this concept entirely as a Western artistic and literary concept. Before this time, we have always studied the literature, European literature of the 17th century, not knowing that it is a Baroque literature. And that is very important for a student of literature and art.
To identify this categorically.
Yes.
You're aware, of course, Yang Johan, that in the West, in America and in Great Britain, for example, the study of literature for many people not only posits but demands an attention to economic or political or ideological themes. Does that sound alien to you and the
not
way
at
you...
All, not at all, but it sounds rather strange to me, because my impression of the academic life, either here or in Britain, with which I'm more familiar, is that they can nothing is imposed on scholarship. They don't have to relate the study of literature to politics, to economics, and so on. So when you raise the question, it sounds rather strange to me.
It is a matter of free choice.
Yes.
In China, as it is in the West.
Formerly. Of course, you have to interpret the literature in terms of political struggle, in terms of economic development, that sort of thing, which they call Marxism. But I think it's vulgar Marxism, because Marxism implies much more than merely considering literature as a reflection of political struggle.
What more does it involve?
It's an aesthetic experience. It's a cultural activity. It broadens your mind more than anything else.
It improves the mind.
It improves the mind,
in the words of Justice
Holmes.
Yes. What about, Yang Johan, the study of, well, there are three buzzwords in English and American literary circles these days: race, class, and gender. Do those three considerations enter into the study of Chinese literature?
Not yet. But eventualizing these new ideas will come to China.
What about women's liberation, for example? Is that a hot topic in the People's Republic?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No. Race, of course, we don't have that problem in China.
Class?
Class, we have gone through that stage. Because...
you're ahead of us in the West.
Yes, because we find that the class concept of literature is too narrow, too rigid. It doesn't work.
Here's a footnote question to our conversation, Yang Johan. What would you tell American audiences about Chinese literature, or about the relationship between what you do in China and your colleagues in the West, what they do with respect to the literary enterprise?
Well, I think the thing most needed is to have more, much, much more translated works from Chinese, because that's the only way to make an American public know what literature we are we are producing now.
And Chinese audiences are ahead of American audiences in that respect.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We have been translating American, European literature, including South American and African. I mean, it's a big industry in China. Ever since 1919, so we have a long tradition of translating foreign literature into Chinese. But you have done something something also, but I don't think you have done enough.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with Yang Zhohan of Peking University. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Yang Zhohan worked on a study of Baroque literature. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 486. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, the life and times of George Bernard Shaw. My guest will be Michael Holroyd, the author of a 3-volume biography of George Bernard Shaw. Here's news of interest to high school teachers. From mid-June through early July of 1990, the National Humanities Center will sponsor 2 enrichment programs for high school teachers of literature and history. Participants will receive travel, lodging, and a stipend of $750. For an application, write to Summer Institutes, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. This week marks an anniversary for the agreement ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam, signed in Paris in January 1973. 125 years earlier, in January 1848, an employee of John Sutter accidentally discovered gold at a sawmill near Coloma, California. Mid-January also marks the anniversary of the first British settlement of Australia, when a shipload of convicts arrived at Botany Bay in 1788. Birthdays this week include the English writers Virginia Woolf and Somerset Maugham, born in 1882 and 1874, the American musician Jerome Kern and the Austrian composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart were born in mid-January 1885 and 1756. The first American to receive an artificial heart, Dr. Barney Clark, was born at Provo, Utah in mid-January 1921. 146 years earlier, André Ampère, the French founder of the science of electrodynamics, was born in 1775. Finally, happy birthday this week to the American author Edith Wharton, born in 1862, and to Wolfman Jack, the disc jockey, born in mid-January 1939. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Cultural scholarship in the Soviet Union and mainland China, this week on Soundings. Nikita Pokrovsky of Moscow University discusses American philosophy and literature. Yang Zhohan of Peking University discusses the Baroque in English literature. Both Nikita Pokrovsky and Yang Zhohan comment on intellectual cross-currents between their countries and the United States. Sino-Soviet Studies, this week on Soundings.